Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Each month or so, I interview an author of a new or recent book in genocide studies. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Scott Strauss back to the show. Scott is professor of political science and international studies at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and is the author and editor of several books about mass violence and human rights. Today, we'll be talking about the most recent of these, his book, Making and Unmaking Nations, War, Leadership, and Genocide in Modern Africa, published just a couple months ago by Cornell University Press. The book is a thoughtful attempt to wrestle with the big questions of genocide studies. What is genocide? Why does it happen? What prevents it from happening? And what can we do about it? It's a thoughtful analysis informed by a deep understanding of the field and of violence in Africa. It's, I have to say, one of those books that's going to be on the reading list of every introductory graduate seminar in the field. And yet it's written clearly enough that anyone, whether in a grad student or not, is going to benefit from reading it. So I'm really looking forward to talking with Scott about it. And with that, Scott, thanks for being with us on New Books in Genocide Studies, and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Kelly, for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So listeners of the show may remember that you've been on before to talk about Rwanda, but in a context that didn't really allow us to get to know you personally. So I'd like to start just by asking you to tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be interested in the study of mass violence.
Sure. So my history really starts with when I was a journalist. When I graduated from college in the mid-1990s, I was very interested in Africa, very interested in writing, and after learning how to be a journalist in the United States, I moved myself to Nairobi, Kenya in 1995 and began a career there as a freelance journalist. I started out covering Eastern Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, a little bit in Uganda, ended up going up to Somalia and down to Zambia and a couple other places. But eventually I began to develop steady relationships with my editors. And when some big stories broke in the Great Lakes region of Africa, that's Burundi, Rwanda, Eastern Congo, they assigned me to cover those stories. And so I first got exposed to some of these issues in Burundi in 1996 when there was a coup. But the real work came in what's now the Democratic Republic of Congo, and I covered the war there from the fall of 1996 until the overthrow of President Mobutu in 1997. And essentially what happened in the course of that is that what I was witnessing was the aftermath of the Rwandan civil war and the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide, because a lot of the refugees from Rwanda had taken root in eastern Congo, and it was the Rwandan authorities who invaded Congo and who broke up the camps that ultimately started the war in the Congo. And in covering that, I came upon mass graves. I was exposed to the Rwanda story in ways that I had not really been exposed to previously. And that really triggered a lifelong, well, at least to date anyway, lifelong passion, interest, curiosity, and, you know, elements of, I'm sure, trauma that have propelled me on this course. So I eventually went back to graduate school in political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and did my dissertation and first real research on these questions, you know, on Rwanda. So that's a big mouthful. I'm happy to break any of that up or expand on it. But it was really through my experiences as a journalist that I was exposed to this violence, exposed to the Rwanda business, and also Burundi, and that led to my interest.
So I'm curious. And there's the tagline, the Peter Jennings tagline that always goes through my head when I think about the Congo, and I'm going to get it wrong, but he said something along the lines of, came on the news and said something along the lines of, 5 million people died in the last several years, and we didn't know about it. How could that be? Referring to the long civil war in the Congo. And I'm wondering, you clearly decided that that graduate school and academia was the direction to go. And I'm wondering why you found journalism, why you chose that rather than staying in journalism and trying to bring this to people's attention.
So I love being a reporter. I mean, it was incredibly exciting, and there was from a writing point of view, is enormously satisfying. If you had, let's say, a story on page one and you felt you're in a big circulation market, like, wow, there could be 500,000 people who are getting the story on their doorstep this morning. This was 20 years ago, so it was back in the day when circulations were really strong. That was enormously powerful, and you really can reach a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think the real limitations that I felt and that drove me to graduate school were that, number one, I got very tired of skimming the surface of stories.
Yeah.
And it was really evident in the Congo material, the Rwanda material, where you're reporting on these, you know, epic movements of people. You know, the overthrow of a dictator of 30 years, the legacy of the Rwandan genocide. And you've got an editor that's saying, you know, after we reduce this down to tribal conflict. And I understand why, you know, but it also was enormously frustrating. And both from what I was able to communicate in a journalism format, and also just I myself was hungering for something deeper in terms of my own understanding of what was going on. And that's probably me by nature. So, I mean, I am probably more comfortable in general in an academic, analytical setting than I am in a reporting setting, even if I love to report.
Yeah. So why political science?
Yeah, so, well, let me get to the other thing is just I'll answer your question in a second. The other thing is just I really felt, I wanted a family, and the job I was doing was on the personal side, it was just, I saw a lot of lives that I didn't necessarily want to have by the time I was my age now, in my mid-40s. So those are some of the big reasons. So political science, I was an English undergraduate major, English major as an undergrad, and, you know, I love literature and love humanities in general. But I felt that in going back to graduate school, I wanted to have more of an interface with the policy world and with the journalism world. And I felt that political science or the study of politics would allow a stronger bridge between the academic world and the policy world. In other words, I wanted to kind of keep a foot in the world I was leaving, at least that's what I thought. It turned out to be a lot harder to do that than I anticipated. But I do still try, and I do in different ways try to do that, but it is hard to bridge those worlds in different ways, which is an interesting, I don't know if you're listeners or you would be interested, but that's also an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Just parenthetically, I want to put a plug in for a book I've taught, which is a memoir by a war correspondent named Janine DiGiovanni that she wrote a couple years ago called, maybe four or five by now, called Ghost by Daylight, which is her story of trying to escape the world of journalism in conflict areas and how difficult that was. And it's a wonderful book and well worth reading. But you did escape or leave or whatever verb you want to use. Can you talk a little bit about how a political scientist approaches genocide studies compared to other disciplines?
Sure. I think political scientists are primarily interested in explanation and primarily interested in theory. So I think what that means in practical terms is that we approach the history or the case material with an objective to developing something that is more generalizable than just the case. So, our closest would probably be, history. I think historians want to, as best they can, capture the history, the narrative of what happened, the historical narrative. And many historians are also interested in explanation and so forth, but it's really an explanation that is typically oriented toward that particular historical set of events. Whereas a political scientist would approach the same country and say, well, what can we learn from this place that tells us in general about the phenomenon of civil war or political violence or genocide or whatever? So it has, I think, this orientation towards developing more general explanations, which is both exciting and also problematic at different ways. So I think there's that element. I think political scientists also typically have a more strategic approach, meaning that they tend to interpret events according to what the interests of the main political actors are. And I think that tends, from a theoretical perspective, tends to be more of the approach that we would have. It's often more macro level, more focused on the national level and international dynamics than, let's say, an anthropological approach, which is much more local, or a sociological approach, which I think is focused much more on the social relations. Political scientists are typically drawn to the, to the polity, to the political realm, to the government, to the state, and those types of dimensions of it. I think the challenge for me in trying to be, yeah, I'm not saying I am, but my goal is to be both a good political scientist, a good scholar of Africa, and a good scholar of genocide. And the challenge is how to balance those three things. And on the one hand, try to develop a theory of genocide or an explanation of genocide that's broader than a particular case, that's able to be, to do the, you know, be, do right by the richness of the history and culture of Africa and the different places where I work. And that also is dealing with genocide studies, which I think from a political science point of view, I think this has changed, but for a long time it was really perceived that that was more of a normative issue, like that was an issue of right and wrong. Genocide was what, you know, was a policy problem. It was a social issue. It wasn't something you could study using social science methods. And I think that's changed, but that was part of the fight. Not the fight, but that was part of what I was working against when I started to get into this field, you know, 20 years ago now, but not quite 15 years ago. And so those are some of the things that I think are front and center when I'm thinking about what to do and how to do it.
So let me ask you to kind of pursue that a little bit further. Because in several places in the book, and I'm not using your language, so this is my language, but although it's a little bit stolen from one of your articles. You talk about how you see your book as kind of building on the initial wave or set of studies in the genocide studies, the discipline of genocide studies, and building on them by considering new sources and new cases and new questions. So can you talk just a little bit about how this field of genocide studies has evolved?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way I look at the history of genocide studies, what you had were before the end of the Cold War, but let's say before the mid-90s, before Rwanda and Bosnia, you had a group of scholars who sought to study genocide from a comparative perspective. A lot of them, I think, were motivated by bringing the Armenian case into a discussion. Many of them wanted to see the Holocaust from a comparative point of view, and some of that was driven by experience in Africa, some of it was driven by experience in Cambodia and different other places. And I'd say this group of scholars, in many ways, they were the pioneers of genocide studies. They were working in an interdisciplinary fashion and came up with the first set of theories that could explain why genocide happened from a comparative perspective. But I think they didn't, their work, while very good in different places, never really reached the mainstream of their discipline. So whether it was sociology, history, political science, anthropology, or whatever, I think that it was seen, again, even from all of those disciplines, as something that was more of a very specialized, very normative agenda that people had. And I think that what really changed was the occurrence in the 90s of Rwanda and Bosnia, the later Darfur, East Timor, a couple other really high profile cases where the question of mass violence, the question of genocide was on the front pages of newspapers day in, day out for almost, you know, for a while. And I think that attracted the broader questions of what is this phenomenon? How do we define it? How do we study it comparatively? and what methods can we use to study it comparatively? What can we learn from the study of other kinds of political violence to make sense of this phenomenon? I think that it really it emerged as a subject of comparative study in a different kind of way. So I think that's the biggest change. I think in addition to that, you had in general a rise of the study of human rights. You know, look, prior to the mid-90s, human rights as a subject wasn't really studied in the academy that much. But with the end of the Cold War and its prominence as a policy issue, as an issue of concern, I think there again you saw a real resurgence of studies a surge of studies of human rights. And I think lastly, I think in maybe less of an extent, but still real, is I feel that Holocaust studies began to look for ways of broadening out that work. There's been such rich, intensive, careful, thoughtful historiography on the Holocaust. But I also think that, you know, whatever it is now, 70 years later, I think that some of the people working in that field were looking for both to generate insights from other cases and bring that to bear on the Holocaust, and also to think about the Holocaust as not simply this completely unique phenomenon, but one that can be thought of in relationship to other cases. And I think that, too, gave a new momentum or new impetus for genocide studies. And I think, and then in turn, there was I think you started seeing a bunch of scholars working on dissertations and or established scholars switching to study genocide, and that really gave rise to a whole new generation, if you will, of scholarship on genocide that has really broadened the field and I think put it more squarely in the center of different disciplines. You know, I think it's normalized genocide studies a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So I think that's how I would discuss it, you know, narrate that story.
Yeah. So what do you call yourself? Are you a political scientist who studies genocide, or a genocide scholar who happens to do it through the lens of political science, or something else?
Yeah, I'm a political scientist who studies genocide.
Yeah.
And I'm a political scientist who studies Africa, who studies genocide, studies political violence. And I think that's been beaten into me by my training, but you know, it's. Just from a strategic perspective, I think political scientists are trained to be political scientists, trained to teach graduate students as political scientists. And I wouldn't really be, I don't think I'd have the position that I have unless I was able to see myself that way. Because there aren't many departments of genocide, there are not, as far as I know, departments of genocide studies. There are departments of African studies, but they're with in general area studies declining in prominence in different academic settings. It's really, I think it's the traditional disciplines that are where a lot of the action is at. And so I think it's been important in my career to be a political scientist first, and then to have problems that I study as a political scientist.
Well, let's turn to the book.
Can I just add one thing, Kelly? But I think there are different ways of doing that. And as a political scientist, I also really try to be incredibly respectful and careful of the literature that precedes me and the literature that exists in other disciplines. So, you know, we'll talk about the book in a second, but a lot of my book empirically was about studying five countries, four of which I didn't know that well. And the other was Rwanda, but the four which I didn't know that well. And it was really, I tried to be incredibly respectful and careful with the scholarship that preceded me to do right by that. And so, anyway, that's a way of saying I'm a political scientist first, but I am also very respectful of all disciplines. So.
Well, and it's one of the pressing issues both in the field and in academia today is what does it mean to be interdisciplinary, or are we transdisciplinary, or you know, how do you function with a disciplinary home and yet respect and utilize or mine or immerse yourself in the other disciplines? And it's hard.
Yes, I agree.
So let's go to the book. And for social scientists and political scientists in particular, definitions are critical. So what are you trying to, I guess I'll start by asking, what are you trying to do in the book? What's the big question you're asking?
Okay, here's the big question. Big question is really, why does genocide occur in some places and not occur in other places? And so from a methodological point of view, this book is really insisting on the importance of studying non-genocide, of studying cases that had the possibility of being a Rwanda, Burundi, a Sudan, a Bosnia, whatever your case may be, but did not. And the reason, there are a bunch of different reasons why I think that's vital, but the main reason was a theoretical one. And the theoretical reason was that I felt that we'd gone to a place in the study of genocide where scholars had isolated a set of factors that are the typical ones that drive genocide and related forms of mass violence, but that if you look at those factors, they apply to many more countries that do not experience genocide. So in other words, there's a mismatch. We are over-predicting genocide. Or in statistical terms, too many false positives. We are, whenever someone does a quantitative study, you can see for every case that's correctly predicted, it's something like 30 are incorrectly predicted in terms of like the theory would say or the models would say that genocide should be happening in this place, but it's not. And so it became really important for me to try to understand, okay, what's going on in the negative cases? What's going on in the places that have the ingredients of genocide, but that don't experience it? And studying them alongside the ones that do is the way that we can better understand why this phenomenon happens. That's the next, to me, was the next stage of research in advancing this.
And one of the points you make, I think, is once you think about it, is dead on. But I suspect most people would imagine the 20th century and the last decade and a half, the 21st century, as one in which genocide or mass violence was pervasive. But the point you make is that that's not really true. More cases don't end up in mass genocide. Many more cases than do.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think it's kind of a little bit of a sloppy habit that we've developed in this field, me too, that, you know, where we say, oh, the 20th century was a century of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we had these cases that had a scale that we hadn't really seen before. The Armenian case, the Nazi case, you know, what happened under Stalin, what happened under Mao, what happened under Pol Pot, you know, et cetera, Rwanda, Bosnia, and so forth. But if you look at all the cases that could have resulted in genocide,
there
are so many more countries, so many more periods of time that didn't, that I think we have to be a little cautious and really recognize that genocide is thankfully, a very exceptional set of circumstances.
Hmm.
Now, that is a some people disagree with me about that, and again, it also comes back to definitions. But I do think we have to put the ones, I think the way the field of genocide studies has developed is to say, what are the cases of genocide and what do they have in common?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what that neglects is thinking of, first of all, it gives you a misunderstanding, I think, that genocide is more common than it is. But what it neglects from a methodological point of view is just, we should be comparing the ones that do exist to the ones that don't exist to try to understand what's different in the ones that do exist from the ones that don't exist. That makes sense.
Yeah. So let's be careful, I guess. And maybe you could just then say, how are you conceptualizing genocide?
Okay.
What definition are you using?
Right. So I struggled a lot with this in my career, and I, as a graduate student, I remember I took a class on conceptualization, and I ended up writing a paper on genocide. And you know, so it's a problem that has really plagued the field, and in general, you know, plagues our ability to make generalizable findings. So I spent a lot of time on this issue. But essentially, the conceptualization in the book is that there has to be violence directed against a particular category of people. an ethnic group, a racial group, could be a political group, but that it's what I call group selective violence. It's categorical violence. It's violence that chooses its targets based on their ostensible group membership. And it has to be violence that's on a very large scale. So it has to be violence that is systematic, it's repeated over time, it is usually multi-agency violence, meaning that it's you're dealing with the army or several units in an army and the police and the civilian administration, or if you're dealing with non-state actors, it's some coordination that exists between different commanders, and basically it's violence that repeats over time and over space on a systematic scale against a group. Now, in the book, I also talk about specifically genocidal violence, which is violence that has those features, but that also is aimed at the destruction of the group. So that is, the kind of classic understanding of genocide is that you need to have a specific intent to destroy the group, a specific, on the part of perpetrators, the specific almost extermination mode. And at the end of the day, in the book and in general, I think it can be very difficult in practice to know whether or not that specific intent exists. And we can certainly, there are, there's the Holocaust, where it's really clear. But in a lot of cases, it's, I think, difficult to really know if that intent exists. And so from an empirical point of view, what we can look for is there a large-scale, systematic violence that's practiced, that's exercised against a specific group? And that's ultimately the character of violence that I'm most interested in.
You talk about a logic of genocide, and you kind of hinted at this earlier when you were talking about political science, but I think many people hearing this phrase for the first time are going to be taken aback by the idea that there can be a logic of genocide. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think what I'm trying to do is to uncover the inner rationale from the point of view of the perpetrator. And from that, to infer the circumstances in which that rationale is likely to arise. And the reason, and it's true, and you're absolutely right that I get that from political science, and I think that in particular political scientists have made a lot of, have gained a lot of traction, analytical traction, on thinking about a logic of violence. Political violence, a phenomenon that we thought wasn't rational, wasn't logical, but trying to understand why actors would use violence, and then trying to understand from that the circumstances in which they would use violence. And so what I was trying to do is to take some of those insights and think about how a logic of genocide might be different from a standard logic of violence. And, I in the book, I go through a bunch of different elements of that, and I won't rehearse that here. But just trying to understand why, from a leader's point of view, it would appear to be the strategic or the right thing to do to try to destroy a group or inflict such massive violence on the group that it couldn't really survive anymore. And, and for me, that I think about that in terms of both there being a strong security threat to the perpetrator group on the one hand, and also a decision on the part of the perpetrator group that the target group, whoever the violence is being inflicted upon, is seen in some ways to be what I call unwinnable, like that they cannot be reformed. And it's really that combination of the group presenting a threat and the sense that the group is can't be won over, doesn't belong, and is never going to accept, you know, accept the authority of the perpetrator group, that's ultimately, that combination is particularly dangerous from a genocide point of view.
And so one of the things that's not unique, but...
Let me just add to that. I mean, I know that may seem esoteric, but I'm really trying to, in this book, I'm really trying to drill down and drill down and drill down to understand what's going on in these cases. And what the sort of baseline thinking approach that would lead perpetrators to do these things. And why, you know, again, because it's rare, what's going on in those rare circumstances that's different. So.
Well, and so one of the things that you highlight in the book, and you don't, and you didn't quite talk about there is this idea of founding narratives. Can you talk about that?
Right. Okay. So the, you know, the basic argument of the book is that you need two to three things to produce this type of violence. One is you need a security threat or a perceived security threat, and it's typically going to happen in war, but can also happen, you know, from a threat of coup or a real threat of coup. But you need some type of usually military material threat to the ruling authorities. I'll deal here with state genocide, which is the most common. And then you need that threat to be processed through ideology, or it's processed through what I call founding narratives. And so the premise of the book is that I'm going to study a bunch of different conflicts, places where there was conflict. So, you know, places where we think genocide would be possible. That's what the theory tells us. I buy that theory. The genocide happens typically when there is a security threat. But look at places where elites escalated violence, thought the enemy group was unwinnable, dangerous, they had to be eliminated, and places where the opposite happened, where in the face of a serious security threat, the political elites, in one way or another, either restrained the use of violence or they reached out to the enemy group, tried to negotiate with them in a sincere fashion, and tried to find some way to accommodate their differences. So it's really, so the that led me to my conclusion, which is the second big factor, is that there are a set of principles, a set, an ideological orientation of political elites that is, on the one hand, can be very exclusionary, or on the other hand, can be more pluralistic or inclusionary. So, and I call that the founding narrative. What do the elites say the state and the nation are all about? Do they say that the state and nation are principally for a central ethnic or racial or religious group, or do they see the nation as fundamentally composed of a plural community? And that then gets that principle, that ideology, that what I call a founding narrative, then gets filtered into the military crisis. And so when you get a military crisis, and the threat is coming from a group that lies outside of that founding narrative, that's seen as not a core population to the state, that's when the sort of dynamics of using mass violence to destroy the threat arise. And by contrast, where you have narratives that are much more plural, much more inclusive, and so forth, there you get a restraint on the use of maximum violence, and you get elites who want to bring in those, want to bring in the enemy group and try to compromise or find a solution. Or even if they don't do that, they're not willing to, you know, destroy the group that's posing the threat. And so it's really through the comparison of cases that otherwise look very similar from a kind of structural point of view, from what we think causes genocide, but that have different outcomes, that have different results. It's through that comparison that I come up with this conclusion that it's about this sort of long-running legacy of of ideology or founding narrative. I hope that's not too confusing. I mean,
When I teach several subjects, I often point out this kind of change in the American metaphor for what America is supposed to be, from the melting pot of the ABC after school specials, which for non-US listeners are a series of kind of TV broadcasts 30 years or so that were meant to, in cartoon form, illustrate what America was about, to the tossed salad metaphor that is now taught to my kids anyway in middle school and high school. And I started out actually as my academic career as a historian of the Habsburg monarchy in the First World War, which really can be understood as a squabble, in, at least from the Habsburg perspective, about what founding narrative was the one that everybody should buy into for that empire.
Uh-huh.
So how did you go about finding out what these founding narratives were?
Yeah, well, in the book, the main way is that I study what presidents say. And the empirical method was to find two times during the year when every year presidents made national addresses to their populations. And so what I did is I went, in most cases, back to the original newspapers of record, got the original speeches, photocopied and analyzed them from basically independence until the point of the crisis, crisis would be in these countries, and then trace how those ideas that I was calling founding narratives that you would see across all these different speeches, whether or not they played out in the crisis themselves, in the military crisis themselves. So it was really through studying the content of what presidents said that I tried to elicit this, these narratives, and then try to see whether or not there was a secondary literature that agreed, that whether or not there was any consistency, like this is how scholars who have been working on these countries for years, whether or not that was something that they too were seeing in terms of the core politics of the country.
So I've got to be the historian for a moment.
Sure.
And I think this is point. I think there's an answer in your book that I'm kind of pointing to, but the historian then is tempted to argue, to ask the question, you've looked at this more or less from an elite level. How do you know whether the ordinary people on the street heard these speeches, cared about these speeches, believed in what they were saying, did what they were being urged to do?
Yep. Yeah. So it's the right question to ask. And I didn't investigate that directly in the book. Instead, what I tried to understand was whether or not there was a kind of what I call a resonance, a social and cultural resonance of the values that the elites were promoting with some of the everyday practices in the society. So I'll take the example of Mali, which is a good example, where you had in the 90s a leadership that was emphasizing it was a multi-ethnic nation, a nation based on dialogue, a nation based on pluralism, and they then reached into their deep history, going back to the 14th, 15th century, when there was a great Mali Empire, to say our Mali Empire was constructed by this, by building a big tent, plural system. And then in the everyday practices of Malians, which does date back to that period, you have a practice called cousinage or joking relationships, anthropological terms, where people in everyday life are often joking with people who have different last names about their history together. And it's a way of conflict resolution at a local level, but everyone has a sense in Mali and that, that they're living in the same space as people of other ethnic groups, but it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. It's like something you joke about. It's something you make fun of. It's something you live with all the time. And people are bound together through history that they live together in the same space. And they can do that, and they can joke about it, and they can have those kinds of relationships. And the elites kind of crafted a whole political narrative out of that, And I think that, again, there's a connection there between what's happening at the local level, at the social level, and what's happening at the national level. So that's part of the answer. And the other part mm-hmm. of the answer is I do, at the end of the day, see genocide as a top-down process.
Yeah.
And I really do think that, you know, the more I've studied this, the more I feel that for the most part, you need to have the, you know, the central government or the central authorities committed to this program and typically initiating it. That's not to say local actors aren't important by any stretch of the imagination, but that in terms of the origin of the practice and the origin of the policy, it's coming from the elite rather than from the local level in general.
Mm-hmm.
In general.
So you do several lengthy case studies and then a variety of smaller examples. The longer case studies all come from Africa. Why choose Africa as the location for to draw your
yep.
sources from
yep.
or your studies
yep.
from?
So the other critique of genocide studies that I have is that I feel that we've been comparing cases that are really, really different to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been looking at Cambodia and the Armenian genocide in the late Ottoman Empire to the Nazi Holocaust to Rwanda and Bosnia, you know, really different countries, really different time periods,
mm-hmm.
Really different regions. And that, I think, makes it harder to isolate what's specifically going on in these places that's different from the places where the violence does not occur, because these are countries that are so different between each other. And in some ways, the cases and the violence are so different between each other.
Mm-hmm.
So what I try to do is to reorient the comparative framework, that is, what I'm comparing, you know, comparing one to the other, away from this trans-historical, trans-regional approach to a more focused one. And so I did that both in terms of time and in terms of location.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of, you know, to get to answer your question, in terms of location, in terms of geography, I wanted to have countries that came from the same region and that were relatively similar in terms of colonial history, in terms of economic structure or level of income, in terms of general influences on one another, things of that nature. And so that's why that led me to an African comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically looking for, you know, what we would call, you know, homogeneity or the homogeneity of comparison,
mm-hmm.
Comparisons that are relatively more similar. And so that's what led me. And then in Africa, the other reason for Africa is you have both, again, a variety of cases that did result in genocide and mass violence and a variety of cases that didn't. So there's a lot of variation there that I felt was important to study.
So there's no way we can talk about all of the examples. So let's just pick one,
uh-huh.
The Ivory Coast, Côte d'Ivoire. Can you maybe sum, and you're not going to do another interview with me after you hear this question, but can you maybe summarize what happens in this in this place that makes people afraid genocide
sure.
is going to occur there?
Yeah, Côte d'Ivoire was one one of the key cases of the book, and I really studied it hard or tried to study it hard for basically
mm-hmm.
close to 8 years. And so here are the risk factors that were happening in Côte d'Ivoire. You had a country that was experiencing a civil war. So I guess maybe I should back up and say something about Côte d'Ivoire. This Côte d'Ivoire is in West Africa. It's a country that for many years was very, very stable, one of great economic growth. It's the largest producer of cocoa in the world, one of the largest of coffee, and it's just a kind of agricultural powerhouse in West Africa and one of the economic engines of that region. And it had its first president, Félix Houphouët-Boigny, who was the architect of much of Côte d'Ivoire's success, passed away in the early 1990s. And what followed was a very complicated history, but essentially it became a succession fight. Who was going to replace him? And the terms of that succession fight were fought over who was a true Ivorian and who was not.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not one of the key candidates who was Muslim and who was a northerner could in fact serve as the inheritor of the Cote d'Ivoire legacy, could be a president, could be a candidate. And his name is Alassane Ouattara, now president, which for reasons I'll get to in a minute. But he was excluded. And that began the birth of a doctrine in Cote d'Ivoire called Ivoirite, or this concept that the true Ivoirian, the country, belonged to a particular category of Ivoirians, and those were Southerners and those were Christians. And so from the point of view of a risk factor, it had one of the key ones that in the literature on genocide people point to, which is nationalism, which is this idea, again, of a kind of ethnic nationalism, which I agree with, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Over time in Cote d'Ivoire, there were a lot of political instability. You had the exclusion of this Muslim candidate. You had followed by a coup, followed by a very violent election in the early 2000s, followed by a civil war that started in 2002. And the civil war essentially pitted the northern rebel group from the north, who were primarily Muslims, against the government forces, which were based in the south, and were predominantly, at least on the government side, had a lot of Christian and southern representation. So from the point of view of genocide studies, it had the big risk factors going for it. You had a civil war. You had serious political instability. You had an ideological orientation which suggested that there was one group that should be excluded and discriminated against, which they were, and one that to whom the country belonged. And in addition to that, you had these other factors that in genocide studies we think are very important, which is you had a militia group. You had a group called the Jeunes Patriotes, who were the firebrand wing of the ruling party that were committing violence. You had a kind of hate media. You had a little bit of an economic decline in the country. So when you're looking at genocide and you're looking at the factors that can cause it, Cote d'Ivoire was sort of hitting all of those buttons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of alarm bells going off in the international community about another Rwanda, about the potential for genocide in Cote d'Ivoire, going back to 2002 and stretching all the way to what became a second round of civil war in 2010 and 2011. So, but it never happened,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I got interested in Cote d'Ivoire initially because everyone was comparing it to Rwanda, and yet when I looked at the dynamics of violence in Cote d'Ivoire, they were really different from Rwanda. And even though everyone was talking about hate media and whatnot, when I studied what people were saying, political leaders were saying, it was different. It had a different character to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what brought me to Cote d'Ivoire to begin with and started my interview process and started my investigation of that case to try to understand what was different. And so, I don't know if that is that a concise enough history of Cote d'Ivoire?
Yeah, it's remarkable.
Okay, so that's what got me going. And really my conclusions for Cote d'Ivoire were, okay, so if you were to ask anyone in the policy world, like, why didn't Cote d'Ivoire result in mass violence and genocide, the answer would be international intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that starting from 2002, there was a robust international intervention led initially by France and the West African Community of States, ECOWAS, and then supplemented and taken over by the United Nations, which had a very large peacekeeping force on the ground in Cote d'Ivoire. And from my perspective, I think that's true, right? The presence of international peacekeepers played a positive role. But from my perspective, from a comparative perspective, I also was not satisfied by that because I had seen other cases where international peacekeepers were present and where that both enraged different actors and in and of itself was not sufficient to cause escalation that could lead to mass violence. We forget that in Rwanda, even if it was a different force, and in Bosnia, you had UN international involvement. Mm-hmm. And rather than serving to tamp down the violence, it actually seems to, in some ways, have aided to in the escalation of it. So I was trying to understand, again, what was different in Cote d'Ivoire. And my answer really, at the end of the day, it started at, you know, I got the idea from interviews I conducted with intellectuals in Cote d'Ivoire and people in the military. And I would go to them and I would say, you know, look, I'm a scholar of Rwanda. People are comparing Rwanda to Cote d'Ivoire. Like, why is Cote d'Ivoire not worse than it is? And they would look at me like, are you crazy? Cote d'Ivoire is terrible. Like, we can't believe what's happening in Cote d'Ivoire. How can you come and say, you know, it's not worse in Cote d'Ivoire and so forth? But eventually, the you know, the conversation got going. And, you know, in the military, you know, I was interviewing colonels, majors, you know, I was trying to get up as high up as I could in the military. And you know, basically, you know, when I'd probe them and probe them, I'd say, look, we don't have an ethnic definition of the enemy. We don't see the enemy as an ethnic group. Fundamentally, there's no operating manual. There's no sense in the military that this is a this group is defined in ethnic or religious terms. And moreover, that would usually prompt a long soliloquy on the history of the person I was speaking to, in which they would talk about, you know, my sister is this, my brother married so and so. You know, we are a mixed country. We this in French. You know, we are a country of brassage, of mixturing and intermixing, if you will. And I would, you know, almost to the T, everyone that I would push on this question would come back to this point. It's a country of movement, of migration, of mixing. We don't think, despite Ivoirite, at root, we don't think about ourselves or as the country as having a specific ethnic or religious character. So that raised the question for me of why. You know, why weren't the political elites, the military elites, why weren't they thinking about the country in this way? It was right before them to be able to do it, and you had a group of political actors who were trying to, who were making that argument, right? And so, you know, ultimately, I felt that there was a strong narrative in Cote d'Ivoire about the importance of unity, tolerance, pluralism and mixing that had really been instilled by the first president, by Félix Houphouët-Boigny, who was not a Democrat. He was, you know, he was an authoritarian. He did not like dissent. He did not like opposition. But he saw his job as the founding leader of Cote d'Ivoire, not only to grow the country and modernize the country, but to make a nation, to make a country, make a plural community out of some 60 tribes, sorry, 60 ethnic groups, and a bunch of different religions. And when you go back and you studied, you know, his speeches and you studied what his priorities were, over and over again in his speeches, you see things like, you know, our job as Ivoirians is to tolerate each other, is to figure out what our commonalities are, to have unity and you know, even his posters, and I have one that I reproduced in the book, is about unity and dialogue. And at the end of the day, I think that created a rich, powerful narrative in Cote d'Ivoire, particularly among the elites, but I think it did extend down below them, about what the country stood for, what the country was about. And when they looked at their own history, they said, look, Cote d'Ivoire under Houphouët-Boigny was thriving. It was a country where we became something out of nothing. We grew, we had this incredible, you know, we became this major cocoa producer in the world. It had political clout, et cetera, et cetera. And so he was someone that was charismatic. I think that he was someone that people had respect for. And they remembered him saying, we stand for unity, we stand for dialogue, we stand for tolerance, we stand for pluralism. And I think that narrative remains very, very powerful in the country and restrained the use of violence, restrained at least the escalation of violence in the country. Mm-hmm. Those ideas restrained the escalation of violence. And so that's really... That's the main, you know, that's what I think mattered in Cote d'Ivoire. And there's a secondary argument about the economics of Cote d'Ivoire, which which are about how the country, its tax base is really agricultural, or at least has been agricultural. And the would-be targets of mass violence were many of the laborers in that agricultural system, for complex reasons I can go into, but maybe too far afield for our conversation. And so if there were to have been a genocide, it would have really harmed the revenue of the country and harmed the tax base and the economic vitality of the country that did still exist. And I think that created a kind of argument for moderates, an argument for economic elites to say, just like, maybe you guys have your differences, but don't go around killing everybody, because we have a lot here that we want to protect. And I think that too played a role in Coaches One.
So when you talked about Mali, you talked about the long history of this kind of integration and multi-ethnic nature of the society. What is it of the Cote d'Ivoirean president? What was it that made the narrative he tried to propagate or to present? Why did people accept it? And when they were less willing to accept the later counter narrative that attempted to make the country into a nationalist country?
Yeah. I don't have a great answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think my speculation is that I don't have a great answer to that question. I don't have a great answer to why he chose that as his as his approach. Again, I can speculate on that, but I don't have a great answer to that question. I think that they accepted it in part because of the practice of what was done.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are times when you can have a pluralist narrative that is essentially a cover for what is the ethnic domination of one group in a country. And I think in the case of Cote d'Ivoire, that really wasn't the case. I mean, they're not the president, Houphouët-Boigny, definitely favored his own ethnic group. But he was very conscious of the advancement of many groups in Cote d'Ivoire. He saw that, again, as integral to his political mission. So whether it was his cabinet, whether it was investments in education or in hospitals or whatever it would be, he very much distributed the wealth of the country across it and across different groups. And if you were receiving a scholarship to study abroad, it wasn't just one ethnic group that was getting them. In fact, it was often the case that it was the ethnic group that represented the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the reality also was, you know, conformed to the speeches or the propaganda or the ideology, the vision. And I think that made it more palatable. And then related to that is you also had the agricultural approach of the country. What Houphouët-Boigny and also the French before him encouraged was physical migration. So you had people moving from one part of the country to other parts of the country to grow crops. And that's part of the problem in Cote d'Ivoire that has to do with land and land rights and who owns the land, who has access to the land, and so forth. But again, the practice was, it's not like every ethnic group in this country has a right to go where he, you know, every member of an ethnic group has a right to go where he or she wishes. And that, I think, led to, again, a kind of mixing of groups, and also, again, just a sense that this was a country, fundamentally, that was multi-ethnic.
Mm-hmm.
And that practice, I think, also contributed to the acceptance of his vision.
So, in some ways, that's a way of my question's a way of transitioning to maybe your conclusion. And I should pause and say there's a lot more to this book than we've been able to get to. And I encourage people to go out and read it and buy it, and because it's really a thoughtful analysis of the subject. But for matters of time, let's kind of think about the conclusion. And you take pains to explain you're not a policymaker, but you do draw some general principles from your study. And I wonder if you might just identify one or two or three that you think are particularly important in terms of thinking about how genocide can be maybe prevented or at least made less likely.
Yeah. So, well, first of all, thanks for the kind words about the book. And this is the first interview I've done on it, and so I feel I'm, you know, maybe in a year I'll have more concise answers to your question. but I appreciate that very much. So, but look, on the prevention side, I think, as you really, I accept the difference between essentially prevention, where you're trying to stop this violence from happening, from ever starting, basically, and response, which is like the violence is starting and you want to try to mitigate it or stop it. And those are two different, in a way, issues. And very roughly speaking, I think on the prevention side, it's domestic actors that are most important. And on the response side, it's going to be more the international or external actors who have more margin for maneuver. So on the domestic side, on the prevention side, the conclusion of the book is, and you can't engineer this, but it's still the conclusion, which is it's really important for leaders in plural countries to emphasize that the nation is composed of multiple groups, and it does not belong to a hierarchy of groups, not a single group that really has power, and that they look for ways to share power, distribute power in non-exclusive ways. And that's a little bit of a pipe dream, but still, I think, at the end of the day, you know, a fundamental conclusion of the book and something that we should be emphasizing pluralism. I'm not saying democracy, that's a different question, but pluralism, about multi-ethnic belonging or multi-religious belonging in the same state. The second thing is, and again, a little bit of a pipe dream, but nonetheless, you have to put on the table, is that, and these issues are related, but to try to stop war. You know, and because still at the end of the day, it's security dynamics that drive the use of violence, that push leaders to use violence to solve problems. That really, in my view, only happens in the context of threat or the perception of threat. And so the question is, how do you reduce threat? And so one way is to try to figure out a way to mediate between armed actors or to prevent the outbreak of war in the first place. And that's one of the reasons why I say conflict management is actually essential to the question of prevention of genocide. And we think about these as separate fields, but they really should be integrated fields in some way. And then if a conflict does break out, trying to find ways to, in one way or another, diminish the threats on both sides, whether through peacekeeping, whether through information, whether through the restriction of arms to a particular area. I mean, again, very difficult to do, but those are the principles that flow from the book. Those are some of the most important on the domestic side. And then I guess the third one would be the sort of diversifying of economies and creating economic incentives for the restraint on the use of violence. On the international side, I think there I conclude that, one, actors in these places are sensitive to costs. In other words, that they are aware, they're making calculations about what to do. And it's important to try to get in their heads to say, if you do this, if you escalate violence, then you want to be able to, you're going to face these new costs. And so whether it's the threat of prosecution, whether it's the threat of sanctions or targeted sanctions, you know, in theory, they should work. They don't often work in practice, but they should in theory work, or at least my conclusion suggests that elites are paying attention to these kinds of issues. And then in the case where the, you know, raising the costs fails and you're still escalating, the violence is still escalating, then I think it's really about trying to handicap the ability to use violence in a mass systematic fashion. So to go back to our definitional conversation, I draw from my analysis of the concept policy prescriptions that have to do with trying to interrupt the mechanics of building a genocide coalition. So whether at the national level among elites, or whether at the local level where they are actually committing the violence against individuals, that the international approach should be to try to interrupt that process in some fashion. Again, not easy, but it's providing some concrete principles in mind that can guide the international response to these kinds of atrocity situations.
Well, we've taken a lot of your time, and I think you and I could probably talk for another hour or so, but that seems unfair. And so thank you very much for being on the show. I just have a couple kind of concluding questions, and they're pretty standard questions. And so the first is, for people interested in going further, whether that's broadly in genocide studies or in African studies, what one or two things would you recommend they read or see?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I've been thinking about that question. And so, what to say, there's a book that I recently read, which I found very disturbing and yet also very, very compelling. And that is a book by someone I know, but I still think the book is fantastic, by a journalist named Thierry Cruvellier. C-R-U-V-E-L-L-E-R. And he wrote a book called The Master of Confessions, Making of a Khmer Rouge Torture. And essentially what it is a study of the trial of Doik, probably not pronouncing that right, who was the commander of the S-21 torture center in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge. So someone, this is the symbol of the Khmer Rouge violence, where you had some 16,000-17,000 people coming in, being interrogated, forced to lie and make false confessions, and then being killed. And Doik, then much later you had this hybrid tribunal, and the first case of it was his trial. And Thierry, I think, in a very subtle fashion, very compelling fashion, describes the mindset of this man and describes his thinking, as disturbing as it is. And it's a very, very powerful account that just makes you really try to get into the head of, it's like an Eichmann of Cambodia, get into the head of this guy. And it doesn't have the kind of ordinary, the ordinary man baggage of the banality of evil baggage of the Eichmann trial, but it has a lot of that feeling of like, oh, you kind of get in, you try to understand this mass murderer better. And it's very disturbing. It's very disturbing. I mean, that's a fantastic book. And I think the book that I would recommend also, which is going to be coming out this fall, is, again, a book that I encouraged to be brought out in English, and it's a book that was written by Tom Rwanda, and it's called From War to Genocide, and it's by a French sociologist named André Guichaud. And Guichaud was an expert witness for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and what's really fantastic about this book is it shows the escalation process in Rwanda in ways that I think no other book has. So we've learned from the Holocaust, we've learned from other cases that there is this process of escalation, that there is this buildup and of radicalization over time. And what Guichaud does is really walks us through that process in Rwanda and shows how a policy of genocide was born. And it shows you how processual that was, that is, how it happened over time, and in a way how contextual that was, how dependent on what was happening around them it was. And so it's a really terrific book as well. It's dense, but it's really rewarding in terms of, I think, being true to the dynamics of genocide.
Well, I will add my endorsement of the Cruvellier book. We've had him on the podcast to talk about that book. It's a wonderful book. And I look forward to reading the other one when it comes out. Sadly, my French is not as good as my English or my German. But so the last question is a simple one. And I suppose you're allowed to answer planting my garden or desperately wanting the semester to be over. But what are you working on now?
So I'm working on now finishing two projects. The mm-hmm. first project is one that's almost done, which is a book for the Holocaust Museum. That is essentially, it's called Fundamentals of Atrocity Prevention. Mm-hmm. And it's designed as a kind of one-stop shop introduction to this field. And when I say this field, I mean both like the definition of genocide and mass atrocities, like what causes it, what causes genocide, mass atrocities, and then the emphasis is on the prevention and response, like how do you anticipate, how do you respond, how do you prevent, and then finally on like rebuilding or how to account for after it happens. So it's really designed to be a synthetic introduction to the field that is both that covers those key pillars: the definition, the causes, the response, the prevention, and the aftermath of it. And it's, you know, designed to be short. You're dealing with chapters that are 10 to 15 pages long and written in an accessible style. And so that I'm finishing and should be available later this year, and it'll be published by the museum in Washington, the Holocaust Museum in Washington. And if you're interested, I can give you the background, but that's essentially it. And then the bigger, you know, more in-depth research project that will be like the book we've been discussing, Making and Unmaking Nations, is how countries rebuild after this type of violence, how they put themselves back together again. And that's a question that was sort of is the legacy of this book I just finished, where I spent a lot of time in Cote d'Ivoire and Mali and Rwanda, thinking about the after period and different questions that have risen from that. So that's the agenda.
Well, they sound like great projects, and you are clearly a very busy man. And so I hope you'll take a little bit of time from your busy schedule when they're done to come back on the show and share your ideas with us again.
I would love to, and I really appreciate you know, this space and your thoughtful questions and your listeners, who I'm grateful for them tuning into this.
Okay, well, I want to say thank you very much for being with us, and I hope that you have a great rest of the semester and a great summer.
Thank you, Kelly. Thanks again.
You've been listening to an interview with Scott Strucks about his new book, Making and Unmaking Nations, War, Leadership, and Genocide in Modern Africa. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I talk with Anton Weiss-Vent about two of his books, one of them about the genocide of the Roma, and the other one about racial science. Until then, thanks for the download, and have a great month.